Actually, yeah, what I'm trying to talk about, it looks like a somewhat unlikely combination of things in my title, but I'll try to explain why they actually may have some connection with each other. Actually, what I'm going to say is essentially based on some recent work together with an actual cosmologist, and one of my students, my graduate students, Kevin Tess. And there's actually some background story, which I'll try to skip through rather rapidly, but is sort of the reason why we ended up doing that work, which is essentially the fact that there's a field of mathematics which is called multivariate geometry, which is in a sense a relatively new field of mathematics. It's been around for about 10 years, which is not much generally compared to other parts of mathematics. And one thing that comes up in the development of multivariate geometry is that there's a natural way to define some kind of action functional, and this action functional can be used to, as I was trying to explain, to build models for particle physics. And not just that, but it's, the matter part comes coupled to some gravity terms. And so if one looks at these, what kind of gravity models one gets out of that, well, maybe the point of what you're trying to do is you try to see what these kind of models, gravity models based on non-commutative geometry, can say about cosmological issues. So that's the idea. And to be more precise, actually, what I'm going to concentrate on is two aspects of the story. One is the fact that the kind of action functional that you get from non-commutative geometry, you can think of it as being a kind of modified gravity model. And what I mean by that is that, there's a precise sense in which this action functional recovers some terms that you expect to have, like the usual Einstein-Hilbert action, the usual general relativity, but also you get some other stuff combined with it, which is things that look more like conformal gravity, Bell curvatures, and so on. And so it has a little bit of the flavor of some of these modified gravity models that I've been looking at also in my theoretical cosmology. Also, there's another issue which comes up, which is this question of cosmic topology. So, meaning, okay, can you have some non-simply connected topologies in your spatial sections of spacetime, meaning things that are not, well, in the positively curved case, a sphere, or in the flat case, torus, assuming that we're looking at the compact case. That some more complicated topologies, which locally look like a sphere, so they're locally isometric to a sphere, so they're not distinguished by a sphere or a torus, so they're not distinguished by ordinary general relativity that only sees the geometry, not the topology. And so the question in that respect is whether this kind of action functional has some way of detecting some more global topological information rather than only the local geometric information. So to summarize what one gets by this approach is that there is in this action functional that comes out of non-commutative geometry, there's two things one can do with it. One is take some kind of a large energy asymptotic expansion of this functional, which is an easier thing to do because that gives you something that you can recognize as being familiar terms, like Einstein-Hilbert action, some other gravitational terms, and then some particle physics Lagrangian, which depends, as I will say, on certain geometric data, what kind of Lagrangian you get. But anyway, you get action functionals that are pretty recognizable in the usual form that no one considers them, writes them in theoretical physics. But that's a kind of looking at large energy expansion of these action functionals. You could also look at the way it is, and then it's something that, as I was saying, is more complicated to compute explicitly, but you can compute it for some especially nice geometries, like these spherical or flat geometries. And then you see that in addition to the terms that you see in the asymptotic expansion, you get some extra terms, and those extra terms look like a potential for a kind of Sloan potential, inflation potential. I'll explain how you get that. But and so you can try to see what that, using that as your Sloan inflation potential, what kind of inflation model it gives you, and what kind of data it is sensitive to. And you find that there's a part of it that actually distinguishes the spherical and the flat case, but also there's a part that distinguishes for a fixed spherical or flat geometry, distinguishes different topologies, the different underlying topology, which are locally isometric to either the sphere or the torus. So, okay, let me get down to trying to explain what happens. So there's a little bit of abstract mathematical stuff, which is the non-commutative geometry point of view, but I'll try to summarize it as the main points. So the main idea is that you consider a kind of geometry which is, I mean, it's a little bit similar in spirit to the idea that string theory models have of the fact that in addition to the four-dimensional space-time, you have some kind of extra dimensions. Except that now the extra dimensions are not looking at all like the extra dimensions in string theory models. So these extra dimensions here are actually something which is not a smooth space. It's something which is a non-commutative space. So, I mean, a non-commutative space is sort of more difficult to visualize than what a manifold is, but essentially, is you can only describe it through its algebraic coordinates. You can say what are functions on this space. That's your way to describe the space. And what I mean by a finite non-commutative space, it just means that its algebraic function is finite dimensional, which if it were an ordinary space, it would mean it would just be a bunch of points, something zero dimensional. But because it's not really an ordinary space, there can be a lot more information in this finite set of points than if it were an ordinary space. And the action functional that people in general consider in non-commutative geometry, that's much more general, not necessarily. So here the kind of non-commutative geometries we're looking at, as I said, is just a product of an ordinary four-dimensional space-time and these extra dimensions, which are these small non-commutative spaces. But one could do this more generally. And there's this kind of action functional, which essentially has two parts. So one is kind of a fermionic action, and that's not very different from the kind of action one writes in general with the Dirac operator acting on fermions. So it's very standard. And I'm actually going to forget about this term because that's not the part that produces the gravitational terms and so on, which I'm interested in. So what I'm interested in is this other term that looks a little more mysterious. So this other term is coming from having an operator on these spaces, and it's a generalization of a Dirac operator in the ordinary geometry. So the point is that one can still make sense of the Dirac operator on things which are not just an ordinary manifold, but has this additional non-commutative part on it. And essentially, the spectrum of this operator defines this action functional. So this lambda is just an energy scale that makes it dimensionless, and then you make a cutoff of the spectrum, so you just look at the spectrum up to a certain scale, and you add it up, and that gives you an action functional. It looks like another strange one. So if you think of it, it's like saying that your space has some kind of a basic frequencies, which are the spectrum of its Dirac operator. And you're kind of averaging these basic frequencies that your space has. And that's your action functional. It's very strange if you think of it that way, but I'll say so in a moment why this action functional is interesting to consider, because it actually does give you back action functionals that are well known in physics. And so I claim that this is a action functional for, so then, yeah, but you said there's another kind of conceptual point, which is somewhat interesting in this competitive geometry study, which is that if you forget about these extra dimensions, you just have an ordinary manifold, you can do the same thing, an ordinary manifold with its usual Dirac operator. Then you're going to get back, this is really going to give you an action functional for gravity in the sense that I will explain in a moment. So its asymptotic expansion gives you back the Einstein-Hilbert action and a couple of other terms that are unexplained, but nothing more. So it's really like a modified gravity model. But if you add in this extra dimension, you get the same action functional, gives you something which is, again, the same kind of gravity term, but coupled to a Lagrangian for some kind of particle physics theory, and which one depends on how you pick this finite geometry. So the slogan is that gravity on this non-commutative space looks like gravity coupled to matter on the manifold part. So, okay, among the many...
Yeah. I'm a bit confused, so the coupling with matter, doesn't it come from the part of the fermions?
Which part?
The part of the fermions, or the part...
Yeah, so the part with the fermions is the part that when you expand out this action functional, will give you the fermionic terms in your particle physics model. This essentially will give you the sort of bosonic part, so we tell you which boson fields you have. And so the gravity terms all come from this part. So that's the reason why I said, okay, for the kind of consideration that I want to make, I will forget this part. If you look at the particle physics models that you get out of this action functional, then you keep also the fermionic part. Yes?
Yeah, and are you going to say more about the A as a connection? And what this formula sum of with A and T?
This story here, yes. So I'm going to say, in a moment, I don't want to get too much into that, but so the point is that the Dirac operator, there's one thing which is a useful thing to know. The Dirac operator on a Riemannian manifold recovers the metric tensor. You can reconstruct the metric tensor from the Dirac operator. So in a sense, if you think of the metric tensor as a gravitational field, you can reconstruct it from the Dirac operator on the manifold. So that contains the information about the gravitational field. But also, you can have fluctuations of the Dirac operator by twisting it with a connection. And depending on how this geometry here is built, the possible twistings that you have of the Dirac operator tell you which boson fields you have. So the possible twisting you classify according to how your geometry is made. You classify which kind of boson fields are allowed in your model. Depending.
That's where the Young-Mills fields come from.
That's what gives you the Young-Mills terms in the action function, exactly. So, as I said, there's a kind of, I'll just skip over this, but there's a kind of axiomatic way and the formal way of describing what a Dirac operator is in this more general context, which gives you back your usual one for smooth manifolds, but it makes sense for these more general geometries where you have these additional dimensions which are not smooth manifolds but non-commutative spaces. So you have to sort of abstract what are the main properties that a Dirac operator has on an ordinary manifold and impose that those same properties continue to hold. And that gives you a Dirac operator on these more general geometries. And so there's a kind of list of properties that you need to check for something to make sense as a Dirac operator. And as I said, it can be axiomatized. And probably something that the structure that you get is called the spectral triple, is the analog of a Riemannian manifold or Lorentzian manifold in this more general setting. But so here comes the property that's quite useful and which connects back to things that are actually the usual way they are in physics, namely this part, this bosonic part of this action functional, when lambda is sufficiently large, has a certain expansion in various terms. And though these terms are sort of intrinsically defined in terms of the properties of these abstract Dirac operators, they are residues of certain zeta functions at the points where these zeta functions have a pole. And there are some coefficients that come in. Actually, these coefficients have an interesting role later on because they give you some of the parameters of your particle physics model, like the coupling constants. And they also give you some of the gravitational parameters that come back. But they are only they are the moment of this cutoff function that you use to cut off at a certain scale the Dirac operator, the spectrum of the Dirac operator. And the point is that these terms, so you can write this just as a sum of terms. And each of these terms can be computed explicitly, and it depends on the manifold and the finite geometry. And the thing is that each of these terms is actually, once you write it out explicitly, gives you some terms that are described in terms of integrals or curvatures and so on, and they provide some recognizable objects that I will describe in a moment. But before I say explicitly what these are, let me make an observation, which is that you can trade these objects with this object if you go at sufficiently high energies. And if you want to stay at low energies, then you have to necessarily work with this non-perturbative form, because you don't know that this will be close to that at low energies. And this really requires, if you want to explicitly compute this by itself, not by using its asymptotic expansion, you need to know explicitly the spectrum of the Dirac operator. And that's usually a difficult problem, but if you have some specially nice geometries, like things that are like spheres or tori, or things that are quotients, very nicely homogeneous and isotropic geometries, then it may be possible to actually compute this on the nodes without passing through the asymptotic expansion. That's one point.
So about the effective Lagrangian, is it constrained? Because there is something in physics which you call effective field theory, which basically comes to writing all the possible terms with respect to the
synthesis. What I mean by effective Lagrangian is just that, I'm using this in a sort of not strictly speaking, in the sense that, it's just to say that you get a Lagrangian at a certain, essentially at a certain scale. But say you don't know that continues to be the same as your action functional when you come down to lower scale. In fact, we say that there are some non-perturbative terms that come in. And it's precisely those non-perturbative terms that give you this sort of potential that I mentioned at the beginning.
Sorry, and how different is the story between Lorentzian signature and Minkowski?
Yeah, so Lorentzian signature is, there are some problems with the fact that the Dirac operator on Lorentzian signature, the analytic properties are very different from the ones on Riemannian signature. So part of these spectral triples formalism goes through to Lorentzian signature and part does not. So I will explain how one can use still, in the end what I'm going to work with is trying to understand the effect, what kind of information you get on the spatial sections of your spacetime. So then I will reduce to the case where you can work with Riemannian setting. But indeed, if you want to work with this spectral triple formalism in the Lorentzian setting, one has to be careful about the fact that the analytic properties of the Dirac operator are very different, so only certain things go through and not the old formalism. For the application that I might, at some point I'll just restrict to talk about geometries of spatial sections and then the sections, and then I'll be back in the Riemannian case. Okay, so this is just briefly what I said in words a moment ago, that your Dirac operator can be twisted by some connections, and that this twisting by connections really tells you which kind of boson fields you have available in your model, depending on how you choose this finite geometry, while the representations in the fermions are sort of built in the choice of the finite geometry to the representation of the algebraic functions. So there's some years ago, there is some work with Chamseddin and Kahn, and we tried to see what is a good choice of this. As I said, so far everything depends on how you choose this finite non-commutative geometry, which is your extra dimensions. So what we checked is that there's a very simple choice, which is this, so I mean, I'm going to say what the geometry is by saying what its algebra functions is. So the algebra function is something very simple, it's you know, complex numbers, two copies of quaternions, and 3 by 3 matrices. So the two copies of quaternions are like the left and right, kind of correspond to the left and right polarity. And the interesting thing is that once you fix what the finite geometry is, then you just compute everything else from that. So you don't have to input any more data, and you just compute what that action functional is and what its asymptotic expansion is. And you find that you know, there's a natural, so you look at the counting of what bosons you get, what fermions you get. So actually you find that as a consequence, you find that these by checking the properties of the isomatic properties of the Dirac operators, you find that this left-right symmetry is broken, naturally down to a single copy of the quaternions. You find that these, well, this finite geometry is zero-dimensional because its algebra functions is finite-dimensional, but in a certain sense it's six-dimensional, a little bit like what happened in the string theory models, but so far it seems to be a coincidence. We don't have any direct connection between these and those models. And also, you find that some of these structure, these axiomatic structure that describe the Dirac operator correspond to the symmetry between particles and antiparticles and correspond to the two different chiralities, left and right. And when you actually look at,
Just something you said earlier, how is it that chirality is broken when you start off with something?
How it's broken? Well, so the you look at the properties that the Dirac operators on geometry should satisfy, and there's one condition which is essentially saying that the Dirac operator is a differential operator of order one, which when you translate it algebraically, it becomes a commutational relation with certain elements in the algebra. And when you check what that condition gives you here, that forces the breaking of that symmetry.
So you have no choice.
Essentially, you specify what kind of geometries you're allowed to work with, and that puts constraints on your geometry. And one of them is the breaking of the symmetry.
That's very powerful.
Why is the action functional unique? Why is it the only thing you could have written down is this action functional?
So why is it?
The action functional you use, the trace of f.
Yeah.
You think that's unique? That's the only thing you could have written down. It's like.
So yeah, I mean that's. As I said, it's an action functional that you can define for arbitrary non-commutative spaces. So it's something that doesn't require your space to be an ordinary manifold. If it is an ordinary manifold, it gives you back something which is known, and it's essentially Einstein-Hilbert action plus a certain number of other gravitational terms that I'll describe.
Like f, and that, so f is just, I should think of that as a word.
Yeah, f is some cutoff function that, so if you just sum the spectrum, the Dirac operator has unbounded spectrum, right? So if you just sum the spectrum, it diverges. So you regularize it by some cutoff function. But the point is that function only enters, so you can think, okay, but I can choose that function in any way I want, so I could get things which are very, very different. But in the end, in the asymptotic expansion, that function only appears to its momenta. So it's only a number, so if your geometry, say, is like four-dimensional, you only have 3 parameters that will come in. And those parameters will indeed correspond to some physical parameters that you need to, there will be some kind of fine-tuning problem for these parameters, but it's still, it's not an arbitrary function in the end that you choose, but only finite number of parameters.
Since you work with quaternions, do you have SU2 or SU2 plus SU2 as some automorphisms of this algebra?
Yeah, so the symmetry group of so when you choose this particular geometry, the symmetry group of the standard model, the U1, SU2, or SU3, comes up as automorphism, as symmetries of this non-commutative space. And also when you look at, you look at what are all the possible Dirac operators on this finite geometry, which you have chosen, I think this same one, And you find that, okay, now they're just big matrices, because that's a finite dimensional space, so it's really linear algebra there. On the finite part is linear algebra. So you just look what these matrices look like, and they depend on a certain number of parameters. And really these parameters, which are free parameters in your model, you can assign them in different ways and still get a Dirac operator, as long as, you know, they fit in this kind of pattern as a matrix. So this pattern is you know, dictated by, again, that list of properties that a Dirac operator should satisfy. And these various parameters actually give you, if you, in terms of the corresponding particle physics model, the Yukawa parameters, so masses and mixing angles, for all the particles that you have in your model. And so in this particular choice of the geometry, you find that the particle content is the one that you expect from the standard model, but it's actually an extension of the minimal standard model, because you also have right-handed neutrinos with Majorana masses. So if you don't get the minimal standard model, but you get an extension of that form. And there's a nice geometric description of all these Dirac operators in terms of some moduli spaces, and the coordinates of these moduli spaces allow you to count how many parameters you actually have free in your model. And so essentially you recover all the, you know, masses and mixing angles and so on. And so essentially the parameters are the ones of the minimal standard model extended with these right-handed neutrinos and Majorana masses. And you find that, so the, you have three coupling constants, and those come from these parameters of this function that you choose, this Kirchhoff function. And then you have the other parameter that come from the choice of possible Dirac operators that you can put on the finite geometry. And so essentially, in addition to the minimal standard model, you have a mixing matrix for the leptons as well. And you have these neutrino masses, and you have these additional Majorana mass terms.
But is it fair to say that if I choose this non-commutative stuff to be something different, I should
exactly
use a symmetric standard model?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So for example, there is now a more recent result which shows that you can extend by changing the geometry, this finite geometry, you can get, so they don't yet get the minimally supersymmetric standard model, but they get the QCD part of the minimally supersymmetric standard model. So the thing is that you have a certain freedom. If you change this finite geometry, that changes what kind of particle, what kind of fields you have available. Of course, it's a delicate thing, because you don't have much freedom. Once you pick this geometry, everything else is computed. So you may end up, if you change it, you may end up with something that doesn't look at all like the physics we know. So, you know, you don't have too much freedom to add other fields and so on. So, for example, I mean, with this thing, with the standard model, you get this particular extension of the minimal standard model, but you don't get other ones, which, you know, are, so there's a lot of constraints on what kind of particle physics models you can get from this method, but what is interesting is that a reasonably nice and simple choice of the finite geometry gives you back all the standard model plus these other terms.
So each of these numbers is a free parameter?
Yeah.
In the setup?
Each of these,
all of these, whatever, 18 numbers or something, is a free parameter.
Yeah, it's about, I think, 31 parameters.
All the Meyer and the mass matrix, okay.
Yeah.
What are those parameters geometrically? Because you have a geometry.
So they are coordinates. They are coordinates on the moduli space of all possible Dirac operators on the finite dimensions.
Yes.
On the extra dimensional.
Yes. So there's no preferred measure or anything like that on those parameters.
Right. So they of course one like to say, okay, is there some particularly nice choice of these parameters? Right?
Yeah.
Well, for example, one thing one finds is that there is one relation between these parameters, which is that. Maybe I should say one thing first before I explain that. But I mean, there's like it predicts one relation more between the masses, which is not within the masses at unification scale, which is not there in other models. So, for example, one can get that. But indeed, one thing is that one, since these are the geometric meaning, these parameters, what one can do is look at the, so this modular space of whose coordinates are these parameters. So, okay, it's a little bit stupid, but it's essentially, say, you have two manifolds. One describes the parameters for the quarks and the other for the leptons. And these are the nice form, is they're actually double quotients of some Lie groups. So these are the kind of symmetric spaces or homogeneous spaces that, you know, are very nicely described, and they have a lot of, I mean, the geometry of these things is understood. So, for example, there can be loci in these moduli spaces that are particularly nice. This means relations between these parameters that are particularly nice. So, for example, one thing I did in one of these papers I mentioned at the beginning with a student of mine was choose some particular subset of these parameters as your initial condition at unification and sort of run them down with the renormalization group and see what kind of compatibility condition one gets with experimental results at our ordinary energies and so on. So indeed, the fact that they have a geometric meaning allows you to maybe look for interesting relations between these parameters and see if they are compatible with what we actually know from physical. So, so again, you get bosons and fermions, and for this particular choice of the finite geometry, you get the usual gauge bosons that one expects to have. And what's interesting is that, so you have, as I said, the bosons come from fluctuating the matrix, so fluctuating the Dirac operator. And since you have the four-dimensional space-time, and you have this extra dimension, this non-commutative direction, so you can fluctuate your Dirac operator along the manifold direction, or you can fluctuate it along the vertical direction. So when you fluctuate it along the horizontal direction, and you see in how many ways you can do that, you find that you have this U1, SU2, and SU3 gauge boson. When you fluctuate it in the vertical direction, you find the Higgs boson. And of course, you have to check that all these particles come with the right quantum numbers, which means that, for example, the hypercharges are the correct ones, and so on. So your identification of these terms with the usual particles is justified in the sense that they have the right weights, the right hypercharges, and so on. Okay, so indeed, for the particle physics models, you have to deal also with the fermionic part, and for that, you have to describe your fermion fields as anti-commuting variables and so on. But so as I said, I'm not so interested in the fermionic part for the application to gravity and cosmology, so let's keep on this. But I'm just saying that when you put in that term, what that term does for you when you compute it out for that particular choice of the finite geometry is the coupling of the Higgs to the fermions, the coupling of the gauge bosons to the fermions, and all the fermionic terms like the kinematic and terms for the potential, the kinetic energy for the fermions and so on. Yes.
So you said that the first term, it simplifies in the high energy limits, right?
Yes.
So that does that mean that you get the standard model in the high energy limit?
You get it. So there's a preferred energy scale at which this actually works. So let me write explicitly what you get. So this is the asymptotic expansion for the bosonic part. So you find a lot of terms, and each one of these terms has some coefficient in front of it, which depends on, well, this energy scale, lambda. It depends on these momenta of your cutoff function, which are the part of your free parameters. And then it depends on some other quantities, these A, B, C, D, and so on, which are actually depending, they are expressions of these other coordinates on this. So they are functions of the Yukawa parameters in your describing. And so you have these terms, and if you look at what the terms look like, this is your usual Einstein-Hilbert action. This is a volume, so it's like a cosmological term. This is like your effective cosmological constant. This is like your effective gravitational constant. And then you have a term, so this is a topological term, it's just a form that integrates to the Euler characteristic of the manifold, so it's not dynamical, it's just detecting, possibly detecting the topology of the manifold. This is the Biot curvature, so this is the term that kind of looks a little bit like a modified gravity model, because it has this this higher derivative gravity term, this Biot curvature. And so these are the terms for the Higgs, the mass term, and the kinetic term. And there's a coupling of the Higgs to gravity, and that's also kind of typical of these conformal gravity models where you have Biot curvature and coupling of the Higgs to gravity. And this is the usual quartic term for the Higgs, and then you have the Young-Mills terms for all the other gauge bosons. So in this sense, you know, it gives you back action functionals that are, you know, written in the usual way. Physics, and actually one can, you know, normalize the various coefficients in a more interesting way, but let me just mention this. As I said, all these coefficients depend on these various parameters, and as I said, these parameters are just coming from the cutoff function that you use to compute the spectral action, and these other parameters are functions of your Yukawa parameters in this way. And those functions, these functions here, you might recognize them as things that appear in the beta functions that run the renormalization group equations for these parameters.
Can I ask on the previous slide?
Yes.
So there's no G G twiddle term. Like the there's this G G twiddle term that is you normally are allowed to write down, but it's the source of the strong CP problem.
Which one? I mean, this.
So G times G.
So these are your gauge bosons.
Right, the gauge boson kinetic terms. And I've always wondered whether it's a success of this model that it does not produce. Like, normally I would be allowed to write down G mu nu, G rho sigma, contracted with epsilon,
curvature,
G rho sigma.
Curvature.
Yes, that's right.
So is the fact that doesn't appear here, so normally you're allowed to write that down, but then experiments don't see it, and that's a problem.
Right.
And so is it good? Is it?
Yeah. No.
Here it doesn't appear.
No. You just get this.
And so is that? So I've never heard anyone claim this to be a proposal.
But your previous slide is that there is a theta term. Your previous, the one before, you said there is a theta term. If you go back.
In our dual.
No, I think. I thought you said there was a theta term for the gauge boson. That's usually CD vacuum angle.
Yeah.
Okay.
QCD
vacuum angle.
No, that's right. Yeah. You're right. In principle, you would have it, but actually, you don't. You
okay.
Don't have a QCD vacuum angle. Sorry, I should have commented on this. You're right. I mean, I didn't make the comment. You actually don't have a QCD vacuum angle.
So that seems to be a success.
Is it a claim?
I don't know exactly how to interpret the fact, but you're right. I should have made this comment. You don't have a QCD vacuum angle in this case.
That seems very surprising.
Is there
I'm not sure how to interpret this fact. I mean,
you have parity violation.
That's right. You have parity violation. Parity violation is sort of imposed on you by the geometric constraint.
Yeah.
And so, I cannot see from that how it that actually relates to this. So I mean, it's a point that I'm not entirely sure how to interpret. But is it you don't have that term that would normally appear in the
same. Can I ask a related question? So normally another problem is that if you set it to zero by hand, in the normal algorithm for writing down the standard model, you set it to zero in the action, but then QCD, instanton effects in QCD will regenerate.
Right, okay, so that's...
Could that be potentially not the case here
for geometric
reasons?
So there's one thing here which is that in a sense, okay, all this is giving you an action functional, which is a classical action functional. When you start to think in terms of writing a quantum quantum field theory version of or a functional integral with this action functional, there is a problem which comes in, which may actually hide something that has to do with this problem. Because if you want to write a functional integral for this, what the fields that you're integrating over in this case would be the Dirac operators. Because essentially your field is the Dirac operator, which contains all these other fields, but I mean it's essentially that. So if you're writing a functional integral over all the possible Dirac operators, but then comes the problem of what are the constraints over which you're integrating, because you know there are some constraints for something to be a Dirac operator. Like I don't know, one of that is that it has to, I mean its index has to be some topological information, right? And this continues to be true in non-commutative geometry. So there's an index theorem for the Dirac operator also for these non-commutative spaces. That puts some constraints. But it's not clear what are all the possible constraints that describe what is a Dirac operator. So one of the main problems in making this into a quantum field theory is that you need to know what are the constraints over the fields over which you're integrating. What are
all the classical constraints to relax the boundary map and whatever is the analog of
that. Yeah, so, and I don't know whether this issue of the, because if you're right, I mean, you can set it equal to zero, but then you know, there could be some corrections.
So then what did you mean when you said that you ran the renormalization group for this action? Because usually that comes from...
No, that's right. I mean, I didn't say that you're under a normalization group question for this action. That's the important part. So the thing is that let me say something, and then I'll make a comment about better normalization group.
But the question I asked, I don't think I got the answer. Whether the action you wrote, was it a high energy action or a low energy? It's going to get corrections at low energies or at high energies.
So these are asymptotic expansions, so the one that gives you these terms requires you to be at sufficiently high energies.
Okay.
And what I mean by sufficiently high energies is coming now, namely, you have a normalization on, these coefficients for these various terms, which in particular gives you a unification constraint. So this is saying essentially that this asymptotic expansion is safe. So you can use it when you are when you're near unification energy. Okay. So of course that means that you don't know what happens if you go to higher energies, like you know what this would happen if you go on your Planck scale or something like that. Okay, you don't know, but you have this asymptotic expansion that kind of works at unification energy. And then what you can say is, okay, what happens if you go to lower energies? So at some point you expect that, you know, maybe you're trading this action functional by its asymptotic expansion will no longer work. But there may be some, you know, intermediate range of energies for which it still works, but these constraints that you have at unification may not work. So what one can do to try to understand that intermediate range is do some kind of renormalization group analysis. What I mean by that is that, of course, you don't have an actual quantum field theory for this action functional, but you know that your parameters depend on the particle physics part of your model. And for that, you can do a renormalization group analysis. So essentially, you can do that, and at least, you know, in first approximation, it gives you some information about when you move from unification energy to, say, from unification scale to electroweak scale. It doesn't tell you what happens further down, and it doesn't tell you what happens further up.
So this is a fermion. So you take the fermion parts.
Yeah.
And
you take
you integrate to the quantum fluctuations.
Right. And so this tells you how these parameters are going to change because those depend on that part of the
Your C squared term, your conformal term here, it looks like you could tune it to zero. But in the previous slides, I think it wasn't, it was pain that I couldn't set it to zero. Can I turn off the higher derivative terms?
Sorry, can you turn off the
higher derivative?
So all these things have these parameters in front. So now these parameters, you know, depend on how you choose conditions at initial conditions at unification. So in particular, some of them may be dominant over other ones. And also when you look at, for example, by doing this renormalization group analysis, you look at what happens at the intermediate scales, these parameters move. So some terms may become dominant over other ones according to how you choose your initial condition at unifications. So for example, I know found some curious phenomena. If you play around with different possibilities of choosing your initial conditions and then looking at what happens on running them down, so running them down means sort of going in between the unification and the electroweak scale, so that in terms of cosmological models, you're in a very, very early universe, because you're in between the unification and the electroweak era, not in the model. I will say later what you can do about the more modern part. But the point is that there, for these very early universe models, you find that these parameters, which would be the coefficients of your various terms, so it would be something like an effective gravitational constant, an effective cosmological constant, and then these conformal gravity terms and so on. They are, so these coefficients are actually now allowed to run with the energy scale. So you get, and they run depending on how you pick the initial conditions and unification. So you find some curious phenomena if you make them run in different ways. So, for example, you can find regions of anti-gravity where this effective gravitational constant switches sign, and then the switch is sign again in between these unification and the weak era. Or your cosmological constant is varying in this. Yeah.
So the idea here is when I get to the electroweak scale, somehow this effective action is just a normal Russell. But then what am I supposed to replace it with? What is the description?
So at this level, I'm just saying, what happens when you are at these very high energies, and mm-hmm. somehow you can just play with this asymptotic expansion of this functional and see how. How this running of the normalization group can affect your coefficients. Now, of course, this only works at this that kind of energy scale. So, if you want to actually come down to energy scales that are more interesting for actual cosmological data, you'll have to not use the asymptotic expansion but use the actual functional. And I'll come to that in a moment to say how you can do that. I mean, then you. So you get some additional terms which are interesting. Yes.
How can the gravitational constant change sign? Is there some condition that the energy is overall positive? Or should I worry about its stability?
Yeah. So of course, this is just you can say that these scenarios are just ruled out. So in a sense, if you want to rule out certain phenomena, to say there's this Linde models with effective gravitational constant changing sign, where you can say, okay, those, I want to rule out those possibilities. Just put some constraints on your set of initial conditions and unification that just blanks out certain areas of initial conditions, which you, for example, say, okay, I'm not allowed to use these initial conditions because they give me one of these anti-gravity.
So this is a kind of effective description anyway. This is not the fundamental theory would be to treat your action non-perturbatively.
What I'm saying is that I'm just going to come to the point of saying I want to treat this action non-perturbatively.
Okay, so
what I'm saying is that if you look at this perturbative behavior, you find that you have a lot of strange phenomena that can happen because of this running of these parameters. And if you want to, for example, if you want to avoid them, then that puts some constraints on how you are allowed to choose the initial conditions at unification.
But the translation of that would be a correct non-perturbative description of the quantum theory would not.
Yeah, so non-perturbatively, you no longer have this running of the parameters. Then you just fix. Then, okay, your parameters be just fixed by what the. If you're talking about the modern universe, then your gravitational constant is.
So what you are running is exclusively the fermion, the matter quantum, but not the gauge field. So because you said that the gauge fields, the Higgs,
yes,
come from the Dirac and Dirac.
Exactly. I'm running only the parameters. Yeah, I'm running only the parameters that enter in these coefficients, and those are coming from these Yukawa parameters, that these coordinates on the Dirac operator. But okay, let's now sort of forget about all these funny things that happen in this range of unification to electroweak, which are. But let's come down to just taking the function, the action functional as it is, not through its asymptotic expansion, and just try to look at what it looks like by itself. And let's also say that for the moment we just concentrate on the gravity terms only, and so we can momentarily forget the matter part. I'll come back at the end to say what happens, but I just keep the manifold part that gives me the gravitational terms. It won't give me the coupling to the matter, but just to simplify the picture a little bit, let's forget that part and concentrate on the gravity part of this action functional. And now let's look at, well, we need to look at some specially nice geometries to be able to actually compute this Dirac spectra and so on. So let's look at the question we're looking at is this topology question, and so let's look at the space-time sections, the spatial sections, and try to think that, let's assume that these are closed, and we try to see what signature they can be in this model of whether topologically they would be, well, either a series or toroid, positive curve or flat, or something more complicated. So, first, for example, one of the possible cases which are not, for the positive curve case, one of the possible examples that are not the sphere is this example of the Poincaré homology sphere, or the dodecahedral space, or other examples like that. People simulate as possible in these topologies. So what can you look for that may be able to detect signatures of these different topologies that you can extract from this model based on the spectral action? So one thing that one can look for is this kind of information that one sees in the scalar and tensor fluctuations in the exponents and in the amplitude of these power laws. And because, the good reason to look for something that will give some constraints on this parameter in this model is that these are constraints by observational facts, and also they can be predicted in models of slow roll inflations coming from the slow roll coefficients and the slow roll potential. So then it's time to see whether we can say something about these kind of coefficients, these kind of parameters, starting from the spectral action calculation. So the idea would be to extract from the spectral action a kind of slow roll potential, and then out of the slow roll potential compute these coefficients and see whether they're sensitive to this topological information. Okay, so then comes the Poisson summation formula that I mentioned in my title, because the point is that now we want to compute the spectral action, but we're not going to high energies or anything, so we really have to compute it as it is. So it's summing up the spectrum of the Dirac operator with some cutoff function. And so the point is that for reasonably nice geometries, the Dirac operator, the spectrum of the Dirac operator falls into some nice progressions of numbers, which are like points on lattices. And so computing non-perturbatively this spectral action functional really means summing points on lattices. And in the mathematical method to sum points on lattices is the Poisson summation formula, which tells you that summing values of a function of a sufficiently nice smooth function. In this case, you can get some kind of smooth cutoff, you know, so smooth approximations to a cutoff function. And summing those values along the lattice is the same as summing the Fourier transform. So at first sight, you think that, okay, this is not improving the situation because, you know, you're just trading summing one function with trading, you know, summing another function. But in fact, it turns out that this side is much easier to compute than that side. And so it actually gives you a way to do this calculation explicitly.
So, the Dirac operator, is it supposed to be self-adjoint or hermitic?
Yeah, which
one of the two? Like, can you have continuous spectrum, residual spectrum, all that kind of problems?
So, here
it seems like you say it only has pure point spectrum.
So, you're going to have, you're just looking at some very, very particular manifolds, which are like three-dimensional spherical space forms, so like quotients of the three sphere by a finite group action, or quotients of the two torus by a finite group action. And these actually have this nice property that because these geometries are very symmetric, actually the Dirac spectrum has multiplicities of the eigenvalues. They're not just multiplicity one, so there are some interesting ones.
Yeah, but it's a pure point spectrum. It's not continuum, it's not residuum.
No. This is like the compact manifold, so you don't have any continuum spectrum. Right? It's all this grid spectrum. They're compact Riemannian manifolds because they have three dimensional sections. So it really is just something like this. I mean, it's just something. And the interesting thing is that the multiplicities are polynomial functions of the eigenvalues. That's the key thing that you need in order to be able to use the Poisson summation formula. So, for example, for the standard topology, one can use a calculation that was done by Chamseddin and Khan, and one sees that you actually ending up only with two integrals to compute. So you're trading an infinite sum of values with just two integrals. And these are the derivatives, this is the Fourier transform of this function multiplied by two, and this is just Fourier transform. And so you get explicitly something which now depends on the radius of your sphere, and there's another curious parameter here, which comes in, and it's a little bit like this parameter is coming in actually if you compute the spectral action on a four-dimensional manifold, which is like a S3 times a circle. You think of it as a would be the analog of some kind of inverse temperature parameter if you were on field theory, but actually that this parameter disappears then in all the calculations of the slow roll potential and so on. So
does it matter that you took a d squared by lambda squared here?
Yes.
Because before you had a d by lambda, now you have d squared by lambda squared.
That's correct. But I mean, I'm computing this as a. I mean, this is more like the spectrum of the Laplacian rather than the spectrum of the arc. But
how did we end up calculating the three dimensional spectrum? There's some approximation in which the spectrum of this operator just restricted to the three surface is approximately the spectrum of the four dimensional spectrum. How did we end up calculating the three dimensional? We're currently calculating this trace on the three sphere.
Right.
But originally the idea was calculated on four.
That's right. So I mean, in the end, so yeah. Okay. Let me say it this way. You have your three dimensional spectrum, and you actually compute the Dirac. I mean, you compute explicitly the Dirac spectrum of your three manifold. Now. Okay, if you have it's not really necessary to pass through the. It's just convenient for, in a sense, for the calculation. It's sort of a. But if you take the four-dimensional manifold, which is your three manifolds times a circle, you just, your Dirac spectrum is going to have just the part that it has on the three manifold, and then, you know, it's a sum with the spectrum of, on a circle, which is
the four-dimensional.
So it's still a lattice, you know, which has the part on the three manifold and this additional dimension. As I said, you know, doing that, in a sense, you can think of something like this. You know, your normal space-time would be this kind of a cylinder, topologically, on your three-dimensional section, which metrically is expanding according to the Friedman equation. If instead of a... So if you were allowed to do like a weak rotation to Euclidean signature, your cylinder would become sort of compactified to a circle, and your, you know, imaginary space, your imaginary time coordinate would become a real coordinate with some change of sign, and you would get this, and so this beta parameter then would be like the length of your compactifying circle. So if one way to think of it is this, you can imagine that, you know, so weak rotate your geometry, do your, you know, Riemannian calculations where, you know, you can use this simpler analysis of the Dirac operators on compact manifold, extract something which is now no longer depending on this Riemannian, underlying Riemannian manifold, and sort of weak rotate it back to the Lorentzian one. Sort of, you know, a way to bring you.
So the fact that the answer is not going to depend on data.
Right, that it tells you that somehow. So the point where the potential comes in is that when you fluctuate your Dirac operator, the spectral action part changes by something that is just a potential in this scalar field. And that potential, actually, look at what it looks like. When this parameter is small, it kind of looks like your sort of quartic Higgs potential. But when you get to higher values, it actually flattens out. So in the end, it looks more like a one of these slow roll like potentials. So you have the part that looks like a quartic potential, but then it flattens out.
Yeah. So initially, when you had only the d by lambda, you had the class of perturbation on your Dirac operator you looked at, the ones which gave you the standard model as soon as possible.
That's right. So
is this perturbation of the same kind or not?
So no, that's right. In addition, if you also put in the matter, as I said, I kind of temporarily forgot about the matter part. If you put in also the matter part, then you would get the other fluctuations of the Dirac operator that would give you back the gauge bosons and all. But this is sort of just the basic one that you have if you only have the gravity part, but not the matter part.
So question, where is the kinetic part of kinetic time profile?
Yes, it's actually even in one of these terms. So you see, this A is the radius of your sphere. So one of these terms is like is what you would get as the integral of the as you the Einstein-Hilbert action, except here the R is constant, so it moves up. And the other one would be like the one that has the quadratic. So one of them would be the one that has the quartic. So I mean, you can see it in the dependence on lambda. If you go back to seeing the terms that you in this asymptotic expansion. So I mean, here is the point is that
those two terms are independent of phi.
Hmm?
Those two terms are independent of phi. Is that what the kinetic term for phi?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So for phi, I mean, if you look at what these things look like when this parameter is small, so then you can just expand this out in Taylor series, and so this x is this quantity, so when this is small, you can expand this out and you find that it has a quadratic and a quartic term.
But is it a phi dot the square term? I'm asking for a kinetic term. If it's a scalar field, it has a potential and it has a kinetic term. And these are just potential because just
yeah, but this is just the potential part.
Okay.
This gives you the shape of the potential.
And what gives me the shape of the kinetic term?
Yeah, the kinetic term you get, you know, in the, it has come in, you know, through the, so there's going to be a coupling, when you compute this asymptotic expansion, there's going to be a coupling of D with phi. And that's going to give you the derivative.
Okay, so there is a d squared phi squared term or something.
Yeah, there's going to be a d phi that comes from, but I mean, from the coupling of those two terms. But no, I mean, I'm just extracting the shape of the potential part. I mean, when I wrote the bosonic terms for the asymptotic expansion of the collection, for the part that with the Higgs, which is the one that looks very much like this one, you get a d phi squared, which was coming from the pairing of the D and then you get the quadratic and quartic terms separately for phi, as in this case. Then you can look at, given this potential, look at what you get as these expressions and so on. I mean, you get some ugly expressions in these integrals, but anyway, if you get something explicitly, that you can check.
So in your earlier slide, it looked like there was a two-dimensional lattice-like structure. Is that right? And two integers have been in. I misunderstood this. If you just show here, where you had a convolution kind of a...
Are you think for the summation? It depends on the three manifold because the point is that your spectrum is like a sum. You can divide it up into a certain number of arithmetic progressions, and each one of them is like a one-dimensional lattice. I make an example with a more complicated manifold and the three-sphere, and then you see that you have several summations on several lattices, so the spectrum splits up as a union of different lattices. And yeah, for example, this is another simple case which is not the sphere. It's a quotient of the sphere by the quaternionic units. And so you find that the spectrum splits up as two different series, two different arithmetic progressions, which means that you have two lattices. And on each one of them, the multiplicities are actually given by a polynomial evaluated at the points of the progression. So you can apply the Poisson summation formula. And what happens is that in the end, the spectral action in this case is just, when you compute it, is what you expect. So it's the same as the spectral action for the three sphere, but with a factor that divides it out, which is given by the multiplicity of the group that acts on the sphere. And so, for example, this calculation of the Sloterdijk parameters is going to come out the same because in these potentials you always have a quotient, and so this multiplicative factor cancels out. And but of course there's something else which only involves the amplitude, and that there it does not cancel. But these Sloterdijk parameters are not the same. This is a more complicated example. It's this Poincaré homology sphere that I mentioned. And there it's more complicated because the group is acting as order 120. And the spectrum, you can get the multiplicities from some generating function, which is these horrible polynomials. But you extract the right coefficients, and that gives you all the multiplicities. And these multiplicities, so now you have 60 different polynomials, so you have 60 different lattices on which to sum, and each one is a polynomial that gives you the multiplicities for that part. So you add everything up, and you find what you expect. So it's a 120 time one over 120 times the spectral action from S3. So again, the Sloan parameters don't change, but what changes is the these amplitudes, which depend not on, I mean, which are actually keep the a factor of proportionality. So you see that it actually one can do the same for all the one can do the explicit calculation for all the spherical space forms. There's a finite number of them. There's a complete classification. One can compute all of them, and one finds that the for all the spherical geometries, the Sloan parameters are the same, but the amplitudes change by a factor, which is exactly the one over the order of the group that acts on the sphere. The actual scale factors are these ones for the different. This is the complete classification of the different cases for the spherical, the possible spherical forms, and all of them have a corresponding factor like that. And
can I have a question? So I understood for the sphere that what you took was a d squared plus phi squared divided by lambda squared. And okay, I see that phi, you have the potential and so on and so forth, but so here I kind of lost the phi in this formula. What is the phi here?
Yeah, sorry, I
should be d squared plus phi squared.
So this is just a spectral action without the phi.
Okay.
Okay. And understanding, anyway, this order is the order of the group. If you put the phi, you have this plus the potential.
And this is going to just
and
divide
then,
by
and
one
it's
over
all, it's all, but the point is that it's also multiplied by the same factor. So there's an amplitude that is multiplied by that factor. But the Sloan parameters stay the same for all the spherical geometries. And you can do the same for the flat geometries. The flat geometries, now the basic model is the flat three-dimensional torus, for which, again, you can compute explicitly the spectrum and sum it up with the same method with the Poisson summation formula. And again, you get an explicit form, but now, when you look at what happens when you take the fluctuations of these Dirac operators, now you get a Sloan potential which looks a little bit different from the other one. So it's just one term that's missing. So it's now the fact that this is not just different by a constant multiple, it's also slightly different as a form of the function itself, give you that the Sloan parameters are different from the spherical case. So in the flat case, they actually look different from the spherical case. And also, so that's the model, the flat three torus. But then there's again a complete classification of all the possible flat geometries that are quotients of the three torus. They're called the Biberbach manifold, and they are of six different types. Each one comes with different spin structures. It's interesting that the Dirac operator is different for different spin structures, but the spectral action, once you sum it up, is the same for different spin structures. So it's not sensitive. This is kind of surprising in a way, because the Dirac operator, the Dirac spectrum actually differs significantly, but when you sum them up, the result is independent of the space structure. So it's only dependent on the geometry, and not on the and the topology, but not the space structure. And these various topologies are essentially coming from a torus and gluing with like a half turn or a third turn or quarter turn, or gluing with a sixth turn, and then there is this exceptional one where you glue along each axis with a different, with the same twist of pi. So for example, this is like what happens to the simulated in this guy for this last case of Biberbach manifold, the one with the three twists. And again, one can compute completely the spectral action for all of these Biberbach manifolds, and you find the same phenomenon. So it's again the same as the one of the torus, with a multiplicative factor in front, and that multiplicative factor depends on which geometry you have. There's one missing where actually the kind of lattice summation technique that we use does not immediately extend to that case. I don't really know why we have to still think about it, but we sort of tried some numerical. It looks like it's going to be similar to this case up to a factor of two, but anyway, that you find the same phenomenon. So there's the Sloan parameters are the same for all the flat manifolds, but there's this amplitude factor that distinguishes the various topologies. And in the same way from the spherical ones, they are the same for all the spherical parameters are the same for all the spherical ones, but this factor differs for the different topologies.
Should the answer depend on how you choose this cutoff function?
Sorry?
I mean, this depends on how you choose the cutoff function, the f or h or what?
It does depend on that, but it only depends. The thing is that this Poisson summation formula shows that the dependence on that is very small. It's only true the value at zero of the Fourier transform and of its momentum with
Wait, you had these integrals, right? Here.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, let me go back to where you have some explicit. Yeah, or something like here, for example. You see, the only way that f enters now, it's through the value zero of this Fourier transform, and the value of a zero of the Fourier transform of v squared times f, which are these momenta. It's like when I wrote the asymptotic expansion of the spectral action, the only way in which f entered is through these momenta. So the integral of f and
but the phi dependence that you had this integral over h is very fine. They're not definite. They're indefinite integrals over h, right? So this you don't have dependence on phi here, right?
That's right. I mean the phi term is also coming, but the phi term.
My point. So this is.
The phi term is also, depending on integrals of.
My point is that like that's right. So h,
yeah.
I can, because I don't know what h is,
right.
I can get anything essentially, right? For any choice of h, there is one prediction. So.
No, I mean x is your parameter, phi squared over lambda squared.
That's
your
right.
Your lambda runs the equation.
But until somebody tells me what h is, I don't know what the potential is.
Yeah, h is your cutoff function. So, for example, we use a choice of cutoff function where you take essentially, you take a smooth approximation to just a cutoff, say from minus lambda to lambda, something like that, and then you smooth it out, and you can smooth it out. For example, if you take some things like e to the minus, you can smooth it out nicely, and you see that the error term of how you smooth it out is going to be small. So these are actually up to an error term which is exponentially small, smaller than an arbitrarily large polynomials. So indeed, you're right. I mean, there is a dependence on how you choose this cutoff function, and the natural way to choose this cutoff function is just to smooth out a characteristic function of your energy scale lambda.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the thing is that the way you smooth it out only affects these up to terms that are the order, say, lambda to the minus infinity, in the sense that they are exponentially small in lambda, whereas all the terms here are polynomial in lambda.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean,
if you're close to the end, I'll save my question to the end. Mm-hmm. If you're close to the end, I'll save my question to the end.
I am indeed. I'm essentially done. I just want to say that, that in the end one can actually refine these things by putting back in the matter part and also compute that. And in fact, you can even do something a little bit better than just taking this product, because this product could in fact be some kind of non-trivial vibration, which is not necessarily just a product. And so you get a representation on the field, on the vector space, which is the one that prescribed the fermion content, a representation of the pi 1 of the 3 manifold. And your spectral action actually changes by a factor that has the order of this representation. So you get some corrections of this topological factor coming from the fact that you have the presence of the matter part as well.
So, is that is the topology of your vibrations?
So it's a twist in.
Right, that's right. So, the thing is that the only way, so you can again do the explicit calculation with the spectrum. So the spectrum of the Dirac mm-hmm. operator is changed by some values of, so you have this representation of pi 1, and you can, according to the representation, compute how that changes the spectrum. And again, the different, in principle, the spectrum changes quite a bit according to the representation that we pick. But when you add up everything to get the spectral action, it's a little bit like the fact that different spin structures affect the Dirac spectrum but don't affect the spectral mm-hmm. action. In the end, the only thing that remains of the different possible non-trivial representations is the dimension of the representation. The only thing that happens is, again, a scalar multiple, which is coming from the dimension of the representation.
For the tori, there must be more moduli available. For example, if it was a two torus, you would have Pac-Muller moduli.
Yeah, so this is not, sensitive to the complex structure.
No, but what I meant is there would be a more moduli which are sensitive to the spectrum of the Laplacian would be sensitive to those moduli. And after all, the Pac-Muller moduli are sensitive to the spectrum of the Laplacian is sensitive to those. So presumably the pictures that you have or the spectrum that you found is for some choice of some specific choice of the torus, three torus?
I don't think that that's going to change the actual value of the spectral action. I mean, the fact that the spectrum for the different, at least in three dimensional, no, in higher dimension, it could be that you get different. I don't know. We only did the calculation for the three dimensional case. But I think in the three dimensional case, if you take, just a flat torus
with the standard. Rectangular torus, if you take a.
Right, but for example, there's one of the Biberbach manifold that really comes from the torus, the triangular, mm-hmm. this model, because the group action is sort of compatible with that torus lattice. And so it looks different when you look at the spectrum, but when you sum it up, again, the spectral action that you get is still just a multiple of the one of the standard ordinary torus with the cubic lattice. So there's a lot of this fact that for different string structure in principle the Dirac spectrum looks very different, but when you add it up, it still gives the same point. And in some sense, it's not so surprising, because if you look at what the asymptotic expansion gives you. Now, the asymptotic expansion is just going to be integrals of curvature terms. And curvature tensors are really just seeing that the local geometry of the torus is the flat geometry. And they are not
true,
really.
But I would imagine that the slow roll potential at
lower
energy
would be
sensitive.
No, that's right. You would expect that maybe the slow roll potential sees something more. And in fact, at first, that's what we were expecting when we started doing the calculation, but it turns out that it really sees only this little information which is coming from this scale factor. It's only you're only changing that amplitude factor, and you're not affecting. In a sense, it's a bit surprising. You would expect that changing the geometry in some would really affect that more, but it seems that it really affects it only to that. Yes.
Is that the last slide?
Yes. Yes.
So this is a very dumb question. If I had many universes, and one theory with one set of parameters. I think your results say that you could measure the topology of the universe by fixing the parameters and comparing the slow roll parameters for different topologies. But if you just have one, we just get one try. If you just have one try, do the free parameters that go into the slow roll parameters cancel out from the dependence of the slow roll parameters on the different topologies?
In some sense, you know, in this model, in a sense, what you're hoping for is that all the parameters that you can get in the picture are either fixed by something that you get out of particle physics information when you consider everything, including the matter part, or you know, they are like this additional scale factor, you know, that in principle, once all the other parameters are sort of fixed by the constraint, you can measure against something, or maybe test against something cosmological.
So
this is the hope in some sense of the model, right? Because you have a particle physics input, and you have like a gravitational input.
Good. So is the claim then that there are relations between the particle physics parameters and the parameters of inflationary cosmology that depend on the topology of the universe, which are new predictions of the spectral action?
Well, so see, what are all the parameters that are floating around? So there's some things that depend on what your particle physics parameters are at unification scale. So that's the sort of, and how you can put some constraints on that by somehow seeing that whatever you do is compatible with what happens through particle physics at lower energies, right?
So that's the
compatibility on that. So that's part of the parameters you have to take care of. And this, you need to have some kind of constraints on those. Then there are other things like, say, this kind of parameters, which are not fixed by that, and you know, which it says depend on things like the underlying topology of the manifold you're working with, and which, as I said, they affect things like these slow roll parameters, you know, which in principle one can hope to test against some cosmological method.
So can I turn around? Supposing you measure everything in particle physics, and supposing the universe is topologically a free sphere, okay, then do you predict the slow roll parameters?
Then you could predict, then you could test whether or not this prediction matches.
Is it fair to qualify this as a classical theory of gravity? Because what you, as far as I understand, what you take is trace, and you expand it by either you look at the force mode or you use the Poisson summation formula, but you actually never quantize the gravity part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's purely classical gravity, just that you...
That's right. So as I said, no, if you want to try to quantize, in a sense, the difficulty in trying to make this into a quantum field theory is that you don't have a good understanding of what the geometric constraints are on the functional integral that you would be
writing. Exactly, and this expansion, although it gives you good information, it doesn't tell you much about that particular problem.
That's right, yeah. Yes?
Can I go a little further than Vaswan and say, because the bosonic part of the spectral action looks very much like a fermionic trace, like what you would get as a one-loop trace, the determinant of some operator. So if you have a cutoff in
this
trace,
yes.
Something that looks almost like that, depending on what your cutoff is, you have a log there. But
that's
essentially,
right.
Essentially, you're free to choose any cutoff function.
Yes. Yeah, so you see, in a sense, if it weren't for the problem that you don't know exactly what are all the geometric constraints that tell you if something is a Dirac operator or not,
mm-hmm.
What you could do is think of this as being you could try to do some kind of quantization on this by essentially you're cutting off your Dirac operator at some scale, and then it becomes some kind of matrix, right? So you could think of this as to think of some kind of matrix model that approximates this, but the problem is that you're still in the end wanting to integrate with your functional integral not over arbitrary matrices, but only those that are like compression with spectral projections of a Dirac operator, and then you need to be able to describe what are the constraints that coming from a Dirac operator or not.
Yes. So if I was dumb and if I had no idea about non-commutative geometry, and I would just say, oh, that looks like an induced gravity action because it could just come in such a place. Is there any way, are there actually incompatibilities with the Kolln axioms for spectral triplets?
I know that there were some papers that where they actually tried to do something along something similar, thinking of it as a kind of induced gravity.
Mm-hmm.
The problem again is that I think you can really
induced gravity is where you just start with a phi squared r term and then the phi.
I would say like in this action, if you would just take the fermionic part, and you would take minimally coupled to gravity through the Dirac operator, like it's there, everything. And then you take the fermion, one fermion loop, and that gives you some terms that are very close to the bosonic part of the action.
That's right. In that. No, I mean,
you tend to have Dirac the opposite sign.
I don't know very well.
Okay, yes, that's true. Then.
Yeah, I don't know very well. I mean, I remember that there was something done a little bit in that direction, but I don't know, remember the literature very well. But I think one problem was to actually check the compatibility with these. Dirac operator conditions,
okay.
Seeing when that actually fits or not.
Okay.
Maybe I'll just say, in view of the time, in case people people who want to leave, why don't we maybe call the seminar to a close? Mathilde is again doing the seminar tomorrow in the quantum gravity group, and she's here all week, and then so she's around for to ask all these extra questions.
Yeah, sorry for keeping you.
No problem. Thanks very much.